Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of the Migration and Diaspora podcast, in which we have our first ever repeat guest. And that guest is great friend of Homelands Advisory and star guest of episode number 2, Dr. Martin Russell, aka Dr. Diaspora. And he's back on the show to talk about the state of the diaspora engagement sector. Now, 4 years on from that first interview. Now, everyone who works on diaspora engagement is more than familiar with Martin, but for those of you who aren't, Martin is the founder of the Global Diaspora Insights, GDI, a consulting firm. He also completed his PhD at the Clinton Institute of the University College Dublin, where his research focused on the role of the Irish diaspora in the Northern Ireland peace process, specifically looking at diaspora media, diaspora philanthropy, and diaspora politics. In today's episode, we both reflect on our collective experience working on diaspora engagement in more than 50 countries. We start by talking about the differences between migration and diaspora, before focusing on the state of the diaspora engagement sector, both the progress that has been made over the past decade, as well as areas where we feel opportunities are being missed. It's a bit of a no-holds-barred talk in which we try not to pull any punches. The latter part of the discussion is devoted to diaspora diplomacy, which both Martin and I see as an emerging area of outsized opportunity for governments to engage their diasporas and project their influence in international relations. We'll be speaking and writing more on that topic in the coming months. And during the course of this episode, we make reference to a number of different articles, so I've made the effort to link to those in the show notes. I've also linked to episode 2, my first discussion with Martin on this podcast. Now, without further ado, we'd like to thank you very much for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the show. Dr. Martin Russell, hello, welcome back to the Migration and Diaspora podcast. How are you doing, and where are you calling in from?
I'm good, buddy, I'm good. And first of all, well done to you and everybody involved in the podcast. It's been incredible to see the growth over the last couple of years. So genuinely, buddy, well done. And I think it's a timely service that you're doing to the sector, and we might unpack that a little bit more. Look, I'm dialing in from probably the best city in Ireland called County Cork. You know, people might think it's Dublin, but it's as the second city, we're quite proud to claim to be the real capital. So delighted to have this conversation and look forward to seeing what we learn.
I think you were probably guest number 2 of the Migration and Diaspora podcast, and whichever episode it was, I will link to that in the show notes. And there is a bit of crossover with this one, but we'll explain in a moment how this one is unique in its own right. Same question as I asked then. I can't actually remember what your answer was, but what is your own migration and diaspora story?
I know, it's incredible. Look, if I was episode number 2, I think the only way is up, right? in a sense of building that up. Look, so my own journey into this diaspora world, if you will, is predominantly academic, you know. So look, I went to university actually to study something completely different, and I ended up studying history and mathematics, and I had an incredible history professor who saw something in me when I wrote a thesis that included this word. And he kindly recommended I would go to UCD at the Clinton Institute, because what I was writing about at the time was the role of the Irish diaspora in the peace process. That institute was set up in recognition of President Clinton's role in the peace process. So it was a perfect fit. And Professor Liam Kennedy there, I think, look, as I often joke to people, I think he taught me how to think and write on this topic, you know, so I owe him an incredible amount. And that was it, essentially. So I was doing the academic stuff, and I was kind of finished up in that, and luckily got through the PhD. Did a bit of kind of teaching research. We were commissioned by the Irish government to look at the immigrant support program that the Irish government have. Did a short fellowship at the United Nations University in Maastricht on this topic. And then I was kind of thinking to myself, you know, is it the academic route, or is it the applied route, or a bit of both? And I've kind of still bridged both those worlds, but much more in the applied now. And I guess, again, to kind of speak to that with a little bit of luck and timing, a great friend and mentor at the time, but, you know, kind of a partner now in what I do, Kingsley Aikens. He was on the board of the Clinton Institute, and Kingsley had run a very successful Irish Diaspora Philanthropic Foundation, and that was one of the areas I looked at in my research in terms of diaspora philanthropy. And he was coming back to Ireland with his family after kind of 20 to 25 years in Boston. And he put together, and look, I did a small bit of research on it, a Global Diaspora Strategies Toolkit for the first Global Diaspora Forum at the State Department in 2010, I think it was launched in 2011. And on the back of that, we just began to get a lot of different requests, you know, from governments directly, from international organizations, from charities and foundations. And even at that time, the private sector kind of say, we're interested in this topic. Can you help us? And since then, I've got the suitcase out and seen where the passport gets stamped next.
Something I've always wanted to ask you, actually, is do you identify or have you ever identified with being a diaspora member yourself, a member of a particular diaspora yourself?
Yeah, look, quite boringly, obviously, when I was doing the fellowship and even on the research, I did live abroad for quite a bit, you know, in terms of getting the research done as well. So the Irish diaspora piece was close to me, and that's how I would have identified. And so that would be my key connection. But we might kind of unpack this actually in a bit, because I think, you know, for me, how we define diaspora and think about diaspora is not just limited to countries and kind of, you know, cities or regions. To me, it's about a sense of belonging. As my friends and colleagues would probably joke, I'm a advocate of being the Tottenham Hotspur diaspora, and I probably spend way too much money in following that sports teams. But look, I use that as an example to kind of get the point across that I think if you think about diaspora through the lens of belonging, it can be applied in many different contexts. And I think that's, you know, maybe one of the limitations of the sector at the minute is that we're quite rigid in how we think about the concept and where we apply it. So in terms of the traditional thinking Irish diaspora, in terms of more creative thinking, a very proud member of the Tottenham diaspora.
Fair enough. And I am also a fellow proud member of the Tottenham Hotspur diaspora. Let's move on to the topic of the day, which is really about discussing the diaspora engagement sector and what state it's in, or whether it is a sector, you know, what do we mean by a sector, and where we think it's going, how it's developed in recent years, and where are the missed opportunities, where are the constraints, and so on. Before we get into that, for those listening who perhaps aren't so familiar with diaspora engagement and what diaspora means, could you just perhaps define diaspora quickly and especially in relation to migration?
Look, I think it's one of the big questions that we need to be a little bit more confident in unpacking. I think let me begin by that in the sense of diaspora engagement. So look, for me, the way I've always conceptualized it is that migration is the language of borders and identity, but diaspora is the language of belonging and identification. I think the latter is a bit more fluid, and I think it's a little bit more powerful, to be frank, when we begin to think about, you know, some of the challenges that migration is facing and maybe what diaspora can do within it. So in terms of that relationship, and I think it might link to the point about where the sector is, to be honest, Loxin, I think diaspora engagement up to 10, 15 years ago was always seen as maybe a little subset of the wider migration discussion, and particularly in terms of migration and development, which is where a lot of the focus on diaspora engagement is in terms of international development. And I think that, again, we need to kind of push beyond that, but we might come to that in a moment. So I think over the last 10 to 15 years, what we've seen is an evolution of deeper analysis and action on diaspora engagement, where it's kind of emerged, if you want to take the analogy, I think in that subset role, it was almost like a child. And I think we're into the teenager years now. And the question is, what will the adulthood look like, you know, in terms of moving forward? So I think, look, the numbers kind of bear it out. I know the EU Global Diaspora Facility did a mapping of over 110 countries, I think, last year on terms of a typology of diaspora institutions. And they found different types of institutions. I think 439 was the number that they ended up with. So that tells you what's gone mainstream. That tells you that this is a topic that predominantly, in terms of where we are now in the sector, nearly every government in the world is looking at this, you know, and there's different reasons for that. So what I would say, what does that mean in terms of the relationship between migration and diaspora? I know Professor Jibril Fall, he's a very powerful way of saying it in the sense of when you look at how you define diaspora, I lean into the word the belonging lens, as I mentioned earlier. But Jibril often speaks to the fact that, you know, every migrant is part of the diaspora, but not every diaspora member is a migrant, because you're beginning to look at the generational lens and you're beginning to look at something much bigger. So when you look at it at the cold, hard numbers around migration, diaspora is actually much bigger, you know, and I think we should be shouting that from the rooftops, you know, in a sense of kind of really trying to capture the attention on the size of the potential here, you know. And I think that means there's, you know, challenges to think about as well. It's not just organizations with expertise in migration that should be around the table on this topic. You know, I think we need to bring in a new diverse range of skills. That's not to say they're not important, but I think we need to think more broadly beyond just the relationship between migration and diaspora if we really want to get to where the sector could get to.
And when we call it a sector, what do we actually mean when we talk about the diaspora engagement sector? Or at least what I would say is a sector is in some ways a shared landscape or shared ecosystem in which different actors are doing work, projects, initiatives, or whatever you want to call it, to advance similar objectives. In this case, the engagement of diaspora populations to do what they want to do, which is often transfer different capitals between the communities that they belong to. In that sense, should we call diaspora engagement sector? Is it a sector in itself?
Look, it's a great point, Loxton, because look, I use the word sector to convince people of the potential, to be brutally honest about it. What I've seen across the diaspora engagement landscape, or if you want to take the ecosystem approach, if you begin to think about, you know, what does the ecosystem of diaspora engagement look like? I think there's just so much action happening, but it's not necessarily connected, you know, and I think that may be where the legitimate questions about whether it's a sector or not comes in then, right? In the sense of, is there mutuality of purpose to actually advance this topic? The difficulty we have is that if you have people working in silos or disconnection, I think what tends to happen is that you breed duplication of effort and quite sadly, in many contexts, duplication of expenditure, you know, which I think particularly if you're talking about the allocation of public resources and the shifting pressures that are coming on some of the architecture around the work that's been done in international development, I think that's unforgivable in today's age, to be frank. And I think it's probably at the core of where a lot of discontent is coming in terms of that sector at large. And whether you agree or disagree with that discontent, I think you have to be, you know, responsible enough to realize that that is the reality of the marketplace that you're working in. So I think it is a really great question to unpack, Loxton, because as I say, look, and at your work, I'm sure you've come across this, you know, the people picking up the phone and ringing me on diaspora engagement in 2024, you know, in 2014, it would have been predominantly government, as I said, but look, over the years, we're now working with foundations and charities, we're working with CSOs, we're working with the private sector, you know, and all these actors are out there really trying to figure this piece out. But whether that connectivity is there, particularly with the core purpose of advancing diaspora engagement, I think quite often, you know, and I'd be interested in your reflections on this, because is that you've been on the front line of this. I think that's another question to look at down the road, maybe in this conversation or other conversations. We kind of know at this stage what the diaspora can do. But I think the question where a lot of the main actors are struggling is, how do you do it? What I'd be interested in your reflections is, you know, when we begin to think about maybe some of the limitations of the sector and that lack of connectivity, are we actually aligning our efforts to advance diaspora engagement and the mission of diaspora engagement? That's something that keeps me a little bit awake at night, you know, and that's where I like to position my own work, in the sense of being able to operate in these different rooms and operating between them, you know, because I think quite often when people work in their silos, they can get quite protectionist about their ideas, you know, and feel like it's their kind of sector or their piece to own. And whether we have the courage of leadership to really begin to kind of, you know, share a bit more and challenge ourselves and, you know, understand that maybe we are failing in certain elements of it and push on from that. So I don't know if that answers the question or not, but I think it gives a rationale for why maybe this, you know, that question of is it a sector or not is probably a legitimate one to ask.
You know, it is fair to call it a sector these days, because I feel there is a certain degree of understanding about what diaspora engagement can achieve, the potential behind this. And also thanks in large part to your work, Kingsley Aitken's work and others, there is now a shared sense of, or a shared language about, to describe the different ways that diasporas contribute. You know, people talk about diaspora capital transfer, people, you know, either use the frameworks developed by IOM and some of the intergovernmental organizations about, you know, economic human capital transfers, social capital transfers, et cetera, et cetera, or time treasure.
I have to give a shout out actually to DN, who runs some diaspora philanthropic work in San Francisco, and she's educated me. There's 6 T's now, and I don't know, time, talent, treasure, ties, testimony, and truth. And I think the last three are much more powerful in today's world, maybe.
Yes, but you know, there is this shared language and a shared understanding of what diaspora engagement is, which I think is particularly important, because for many years, people who did what we now understand to be diaspora engagement work perhaps didn't call it diaspora engagement work. And that's still the case in some respects. For instance, when I go to my local meetings at my hometown's Chinese association, you know, I never hear people talk about the diaspora or diaspora engagement, right? Anyways, but so we have this sector, and I just wanted your reflection, since you have been at the forefront of this. How have you seen the sector develop over the past 5 to 10 years, you know.
Just before I get to that, I just your own personal story that you shared there, Lux, and I think it's a very important, even in those rooms of your local association, to begin to use the word. You know, I'm a big believer in that, in the sense of, you know, we see so much work around the world that has a diaspora component, and you don't see the word associated with it. And I think that's a missed opportunity, to be honest. I think we need to be, forceful is the wrong word, but we need to be more confident in asserting diaspora in rooms where it's not already, and quite often as well in rooms that people may think that it doesn't belong. But when you quickly look around, it does. You know, you may have diaspora leaders sitting on a panel that's talking about this topic. And, you know, so strategically advocating for the topic, I think, is important. But look, let's get to the question. So the question, in terms of where it's evolved over the last 5 to 10 years, the way I would visualize it in my own kind of approach to the work is that I think some key foundations have been built on the set. But I'll speak maybe predominantly to governments, because that's, I think, over the last 5 to 10 years, that's where the bulk of the work has been, in terms of governments trying to figure this piece out. And for a variety of reasons, some good, some maybe not so good, but the reality is that they're doing it. So look, I think we're seeing an incredible rise of research, whether that's of the right quality or not. I think there's legitimate questions to be asked there. I think we need to reinvest in diaspora studies to get us to where we want to go in terms of unlocking the potential of the sector. I think we've seen an incredible rise in the number of diaspora strategies and policies, not just at a national level. I think we're beginning to see a rise of, you know, regional continental approaches. So quick example of that, when you look at the SADC region in Southern Africa, you know, just talks about a regional diaspora policy for the region, you know. So, and we're also seeing, for example, at a kind of, I think the word people use nowadays is subnational, you know, in the sense of local communities. But for me, that'll always be kind of local development. So I think the foundations have been built. I think we're seeing a really interesting culture of innovation, particularly from young, dynamic diaspora leaders in the startup scene, you know, particularly around areas of fintech and edtech and health tech and different innovations like that. And I think you have the traditional work of CSOs, you know, and I think diaspora CSOs they occupy a really unique ground in this terrain, because I think that would be my synopsis of maybe the foundations built. But the question I always ask myself when a foundation is built is, so what? Right, where do we go next? And we have to think about that. And I think the key to it for me, Loxon, and again, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, is to really have diaspora communities understand the power that they actually have. And I think, you know, one of the things that has been in the back of my mind as I begin to kind of do more work out in the world and be in different types of rooms, I think we really have to get diasporas to understand not just the power they have, but the power of investing in themselves. When you look at the real diaspora stories that have really driven scale and change and been sustainable, they've had a moment, I think, particularly where a diaspora organization or a diaspora leader, and it doesn't have to be nonprofit, by the way, you know, but I think that leadership and organizational composition, you know, they've invested in themselves in a really creative and sustainable way. So one thing I would say, looking at what we've done over the last 5 to 10 years, I think there's been a tendency to think about how do we instrumentalize diaspora for all the means that you mentioned, whether that's cultural output, social output, economic output, political output, human capital output, whatever that is. But I think that gets the balance wrong if you're really beginning to think about sustainability and scale in the long to midterm. And I think maybe that we might unpack that later in the podcast, because I think there's a disconnect maybe between the culture of work that's going on in terms of where the sector is now to the culture of work that needs to happen to get it to where it needs to go. And I think that's where the leadership of the sector will make or break the future of diaspora engagement in terms of the foundations that are being built. I've no doubt there'll be other actors come in beyond the ones that I mentioned, and I think that should be embraced and should be exciting for the sector. But that balance is a little bit off, I think.
To clarify and also add to some of the points you already raised. So, I mean, I think I have a general sense as well that there's more programs, there's more institutions, yeah, probably more targeted money for it as well. You mentioned the academic and the diaspora research point as well. You know, I think we've seen both the rise in migration studies master's programs, and I've seen also in recent years some more diaspora related master's degrees as well. I think SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, which is where I did my master's, I think they've got like some sort of, I think it's called Migration and Diaspora Studies master's or something. Yeah. And I think Carleton University in Canada has got something along the similar lines, and a few others. There weren't really any
exactly.
Studies.
To jump in on that, courses. Look, to jump in on that, because look, to be honest, look, I'm a bit of a boring academic at heart, you know. I still enjoy, you know, picking up, and I pick the brains of people that have written incredible stuff on diaspora engagement. I've been lucky over the last couple of months to have many conversations with Kashi Talilian, you know, who was one of the forerunners of diaspora studies. And I think for universities, you know, this is such a strategic move to make for universities, you know, not just in terms of supporting diaspora engagement, you know, in terms of knowledge and knowledge creation, and more importantly, the application of that knowledge and the critical treatment of the topic. But I think we live in a world where hyphenated identities are more and more the norm, you know, and quite sadly, I think we live in a world where hyphenated identities, you know, people are afraid to celebrate them. But if you look at the composition of campuses, you know, across the world, not just in terms of students, but in terms of faculty, diaspora is all over it. You know, and I think, you know, what I've seen, at least, and this is what makes me incredibly hopeful, to be frank, for the future of the sector, and your living representation of this body. So look, and I don't say that lightly, we're seeing, you know, a generation of leaders emerge where they understand the hybridity of their identity, and they're keen to learn about it, and they're keen to explore it, and they're keen to celebrate it. And I think we shouldn't be putting barriers up to that. So look, if I was back in and around university full time, one of the things I would be doing is really think about the role of diaspora engagement in the strategic advancement of our university. You know, and even in Ireland, I'll give you a quick example of what I mean by that. A couple of weeks ago, the Irish government launched their new talent and innovation strategy called Global Citizen. You know, the hint is in the name. You know, there's more intelligent people outside Ireland than there is inside Ireland. I can guarantee you that. So when you begin to think about, you know, the future of Ireland and our competitiveness, and don't get me wrong, we're going through a tough time at the moment in terms of migration sentiment and rhetoric and everything that brings. But the future well-being of Ireland will be inherently dependent on diaspora engagement, not just engagement of the Irish diaspora, but engagement of diaspora communities that will come to work, that already are, but the future generations that will come to work in Ireland. That's the nature of the world. That's competitiveness. So I think, you know, I think that's a really astute kind of point to pick up on. And I think universities that make a strategic move on this first, and well, don't get me wrong, it's easy to put on bad courses as well. I think the institutions that do this and make strategic moves well in this area will have incredible rewards.
So to follow on my points or my reactions to your points, yeah, we now have a lot of diaspora policies in a lot of countries. We have a lot of diaspora institutions, whether it's a few ministries of the diaspora, some lots of diaspora directorates, especially, you know, across Africa, where I've done a lot of work. So we have a lot more of that institutional development has been advanced. And there's also found some foundations with putting money in it. We know Facebook, some other social media platforms also have diaspora managers. There's a lot more going on, I think it's fair to say. So let's talk a bit more about what's working or what's not working. I think it's quite clear that there are some benefits to all of that institutional development, more attention being devoted to cracking this. What are your comments on kind of what's working and what's not really working?
Yeah, let's get the bad news out of the way first, right? The true Irish spirit. We'll finish on the good news maybe, you know. But look, just in terms of what's not working, and I think entry point is important here. You know, when you begin to think about what's not working for who, right? So let's begin with government before we go maybe other ways. And if I miss anybody, jump in and tell me, and I can give you some reflections on that. The hard reality of diaspora policy, in its more simplest terms, I'm a big believer in this. It's a minimum of a 10 to 15 to 20 year play to really achieve this. So I think quite often within a lot of diaspora policies, there's a kind of a catch-all approach to them that it feels like it tries to do everything. And I think, you know, you have to, and this, look, this quite sadly, and, you know, whether it's there or not, I don't know, it changes per context, but, you know, this comes back to the culture of leadership, I think, that we have in the world as well. You know, when you look at governments that may be under pressure for elections and different things, when you go in and say, think long, it's usually a bad message to try and relate. But if you're in it for the true spirit of the development of the nation, you know, I think it's important to understand that your diaspora policy work, you know, your first policy should essentially be about building the blocks of effective engagement. And that means not just institutionally in the country that you're in, but in terms of your relationships with your diaspora. So another area where I think we're hitting a couple of blocks is, I think there's a lot of effort and energy around designing policies. The amount of them that transition to actual implementation is not where it needs to be, I think, you know. And I think that's where we need to have governments as well that really believe in this and step in and invest in this. And look, to be honest, I think recently in our work, one of the countries that have really embraced this is the work that we've been doing in Kosovo. The government have stepped up and funded and backed up what they've said in terms of diaspora engagement. So, you know, not just in terms of their own strategic thinking. We had an Albiano forum in November. I know there's some other exciting stuff to come out of it. So I think that blend between short-term need and actually long-term potential and ambition is something we need to look at. And I think leadership within that is critically important. And I think a technical skill that I think is quite often missing is the whole area of diaspora diplomacy. And we might unpack that later, but to get to the question of what you're talking about. So I think that that's the case for governments. I think there's a challenge between, you know, what could be done within a five-year cycle to what should be done in a five-year cycle with the longer term vision of where it's going. I think for diaspora civil society organizations, look, they're the real heroes of this stuff. Genuinely, the leaders that make me smile and, you know, you can see that they're in it for the right reasons tend to be the CSO leaders. You know, the challenge you have for a lot of them are they're poorly funded, a lot of being run in their spare time. So they have organizational development challenges, fundraising challenges, leadership and governance challenges. And that's natural, right? That's running any CSO. That's not unique to diaspora CSOs. What may be not working a little bit, and this is more a structural question for the ecosystem that you spoke about and maybe the sector at large, is in that spirit of instrumentalizing diaspora engagement, particularly diaspora leaders and CSO are always seen as the beneficiaries rather than maybe the creators of what could be done. And I think that's what I mean by the balance, for example. I think that's where there's a little bit of imbalance. And this is where I think, you know, it's close to my heart because I researched it. I think the driver of growth on the diaspora CSO side has to be diaspora philanthropy. It's the vehicle through which diaspora organizations and diaspora leaders and diaspora communities can invest in themselves. And I can't emphasize how important that is. If you look at the diaspora leaders and organizations, as I said earlier, that have really driven scale, and in different markets, not just Ireland, in India, in Greece, in Philippines, in different parts of the world, they've had a common denominator in their trajectory. And that has been the diaspora investing in themselves. And that doesn't mean every diaspora member. It might mean five people. It might mean one person. It might mean two. You know, but that Kingsley, and that, look, I take this from Kingsley in terms of his phrase. He said, that's the developer of development moment. And I think if diaspora organizations always occupy or see themselves in that beneficiary role, there's always limitations to where this can go. To close out maybe on the other final piece of the jigsaw in terms of maybe what's not working, this, I think this comes back to your point about the hometown association or your local association. You know, I think the private sector are doing diaspora work, but they maybe don't call it diaspora work. When I mentioned it earlier, maybe in the context of the universities, when you look at the increasingly, people say the global war for talent, but I can't remember the name of the company, but there was a CEO once, he had a great line. He said, my people keep telling me we're in the global war for talent, and I have to keep reminding them that we're not, that talent has won, the war is over. You know, and I think if you look at some of the major multinationals, I think diaspora leadership is layered all over it. I think when you mentioned Meta and Facebook, you know, that can have applications around, or is it Meta now, right? I'm not a tech guy, it's Meta, right? So Meta now, you know, and I think there's across tech companies, I think across airline industry, across different industries like that, diasporas are incredible consumer bases. The size of the diaspora market is incredible. And look, one of my favorite articles written on diaspora engagement in the last 10 years was in the Harvard Business Review on diaspora marketing. Completely different take to what you would see in the government discussion around diaspora engagement, the CSO. And I think so what I would say is that I think the private sector are doing incredible diaspora work, but maybe where the shortcoming is that we don't actually put it under the banner of diaspora. And I think we have to get better at packaging that. So that's the bad news. Want to get on to the good news?
So we can do, but perhaps it's a good moment also for me to come in and just reflect on some of the things you said, because they definitely resonate with the work that we collectively and that I've done as well, especially when you talked about government policies not really focusing on the building blocks of diaspora engagement. And I just come across time and time again diaspora policy after another, which is extremely long, detailed, and so on. I think that comes down partly to doing good policy is not easy anyway. And the hardest thing about doing good policy is to commit to a small number of concrete actions that you are actually able to achieve. But also, I think as a side note, I think this also comes down to some of the inefficiencies in the international development sector. A lot of developing countries that we've worked in, they have their diaspora policies developed in collaboration with donors or funded by donors, encouraged by donors. And I think that can lead to policies becoming wish lists in some ways, and not necessarily what the government knows and thinks and knows that it needs to
I think that's important. And look, that's not to say that's right or wrong. I think that type of collaboration can be catalytic. But I think the hard reality, this might sound very simple, you know, but every country that's really succeeded in diaspora engagement, they've made one fundamental policy decision. They've put it central to their domestic and foreign policy agenda. Now, that might sound simple, but what does that organically do? it opens up the pathway and the legitimacy for the government itself to invest in this topic. And that's where, you know, you don't become donor dependent in terms of when you begin to think about engaging with your diaspora. And not just the finances of that, I mean, it gives you a legitimacy across different ministries as well to allocate quality people to this. You know, people often overthink this. You know, as I joke, you know, when we think about diaspora engagement, you know, hire talented people, pay them well, and give them a mission. You know, it's not overly complicated when you boil it down like that. But I think for government to get to that stage, making the decision to put it front and center of its domestic policy is a common feature of the countries that have been successful in this area. And success is relative in different contexts, but I think they've also understood that, you know, it takes time to do this. And that's leadership. You know, the one thing that, look, I've been incredibly lucky to learn from incredible mentors and sponsors over the years. You know, and something that always stuck with me was a mentor saying to me, just remember, Martin, you're passing through. There's one certainty in life, and that's the finality of it. All you got to do is to think about what you're doing and will it leave what you're working in a better place than you were. And I think sometimes that gets lost, not just in the policy of diaspora, but in the politics of it.
Another point to add on the government side is that governments tend to want to do something. You know, they tend to want to present something, present a new program, do something that perhaps can create a headline. I'm sounding a bit cynical, but I think there is at least, at the very least, I think it's fair to say that governments tend to want to do something. If a government creates a diaspora directorate, that diaspora director needs to do something. And I think a lot of what has the most impact in diaspora engagement is taking barriers away, removing barriers to engagement, because diaspora populations tend to engage in the ways that they're engaging anyway, in whatever ways they see fit. And when you remove the barriers to them doing so, they'll do more of what is needed. I think that's kind of another inherent challenge that, or limitation that I see on the sector. There's a focus on doing more when sometimes it's doing less that can, or removing barriers, subtracting before adding, that can have the most impact.
Singing from the same hymn sheet there, buddy. And another way of looking at this is the balance traditionally is, what can we get from our diaspora? Countries that have been successful, the question you always begin with is, what can we do? The policy is just one piece of a whole more integrated solution that you will need to actually achieve this, because what you're talking about there maybe include legislative reform, regulatory innovation, in the sense of, you, if you're engaging for financial purposes or different outlets like that. But when you have all that technical process, when you actually link it to the soft skills of diaspora engagement, the number one skill for me is building networks, right? And look, of course, you'll say that, you'll say, I'd say that because I'm an advisor at the networking issue, but I've seen this in action. And the second skill is listening. And the beauty of it is that to truly listen and to truly build networks, it takes time. You know, and the beauty of it in terms of what you're speaking about is that if you do that well enough, the diaspora will tell you what to change. You know, so it comes back to the leadership to make the decisions to do that. You know, so that links back to what we said earlier, maybe about, you know, and don't get me wrong, I think this is where we need a little bit of a transition of who's going to own the diaspora engagement journey. If it is led by donors and international organizations who do important work, to get it to where it needs to go, the government will have to step up on this. But then it's about the type of work that you do and understanding that it is about the listening piece. It is about the networking piece. And to back up for governments for a moment, you know, to undertake reform is slow. You know, it's tedious. So coming back to that point about maybe wanting something to announce or to do, you know, isn't it much better to do that when the internal homework is done, rather than going off in a blaze of glory and disappearing? You know, Kingsley and I speak on 25 reasons why diaspora engagement fails. It's probably our most popular presentation. And number one is what we call firework syndrome. Big initiatives are announced, they go off in a blaze of glory, and what happens? A firework, it disappears. I think you're spot on there. And I think, look, that's what I mean by 15 to 20 year play. I'm not saying that you have to wait 15 to 20 years to get success. You're going to have successes along the way. But what you're doing is building a process where you actually get to scale, rather than one-off projects or one-off policies. You're getting to an integrated response and driving forward.
Every point that you make, it makes me think of something that I've observed myself as well. So I think this is a useful conversation just for myself to get some of my thoughts in order. And again, to react to some of the points that you make, because I think you're in some ways pointing to some broader issues with the sector, broader constraints on our sector. You know, when we talk about the networking aspect, right, so the networking aspect, I agree, is crucial. A lot of the success of diaspora engagement work is reliant on building some of these longer term diaspora networks, so that you can identify members of the diaspora who can do stuff, who can do high impact stuff. And I wonder whether or not And of course, as you know, my work in particular is colored by the international development sector,
yeah.
right? A lot of my work is in developing countries. A lot of it is funded by international donors. And I wonder to what extent the way that international development is typically structured, to what extent that incentivizes or disincentivizes that kind of longer term network building. And just to explain to listeners what I mean, because some listeners might not be familiar with the international development sector. Typically, in a diaspora engagement project in the international development sector, you might have a donor, a government from a high income country, who provides funding to an implementing agency, often an intergovernmental organization or an international NGO, to design a project that has a specific budget and a specific time horizon, 1, 2, 3, 5 years, typically no longer. And then once that project is set up, then the people are hired to do it. And once that project ends, in many cases I've seen, the impact that is created by that project can be lost. The networks built by the project can be lost. The expertise that the project manager has developed can be lost when their contract ends. So that's kind of the something that came to mind when you about the importance of long-term networking. Is our sector structured in the right way to actually enable that?
It's the elephant in the room. And I'm glad you spotted it. And I'll give you another example of where similar tensions play out. And look, if I was sitting in a government at the moment, one of the things that I would be doing in diaspora engagement, I would be training all my diplomats on diaspora diplomacy, right? Because diplomatic missions are the front line of community engagement for governments. And that transition of relationship, if you look at the natural cycle of a diplomat's career, they'll go into a posting for 4 or 5 years, they'll move out. So everything you've just mentioned at an institutional level also happens for governments through diplomacy. So you need to really unpack that and make sure you have the system in place that those relationships don't get dropped. I can't tell you, Loxton, how many times I've sat down with diaspora leaders and the first thing I hear is, well, the last ambassador is great, but this one's not too good. and I use that as a microcosm to kind of speak about what you're talking about here in a sense, because I've seen it. I hear your frustration on it. And what happens in that cycle is that the diaspora get disappointed. And that's unforgivable, right? If you're engaging for the betterment of diaspora engagement, and when I say the betterment of diaspora engagement, one of the things we have to make sure that diaspora engagement does as well, and this comes back to giving to the diaspora, is actually to build the community infrastructure of the diaspora, right? So when people say to me about Ireland's diaspora engagement model, you do incredible work about FDI, and yeah, we do. We have an incredible story to tell. But the instrument I talk about is the Emigrant Support Programme, which is a fund from the Irish government to support Irish diaspora organisations around the world. So to link it directly to your question, I think the biggest question we have lurking with that elephant in the room is ownership. The question is, who is owning the diaspora engagement journey, right? And I think what we have to understand is that international organizations and development actors have a part to play in the journey, but not necessarily own it. And I think that's where you get to, because if you think about it very simply, if we're here and we have a consensus that 10 to 15 years is going to take us to get to where we want to go. If you have a project for 2 to 3 years, it has to serve that 15-year play. You know, it shouldn't just be designed for the sake of doing a project. It has to fit into that world, and there has to be continuity built in. And what tends to happen is that a project, as you mentioned, a project is held, and don't get me wrong, they're quality people, there's good intentions behind the projects, you know, but the momentum is built and then the diaspora get dropped. Right. And then there can be, for example, it might be a year or two and there'll be another project. And again, I can't tell you how many times I've heard from diasporas, well, this organization reached out to me last year, didn't hear from them again. Now you're coming to me. And you talk to them again in 2 years to say another organization. And the question you get is, well, who should I be talking to? Right. And this is what I mean by ownership. I think what we have to get to in a sense of the diaspora engagement journey, I know we're focusing on government and there's different applications, but I think most of our work has been in that world. So let's kind of speak to that. This might sound very simple, but essentially what you're trying to get to in terms of the role of diaspora engagement for development, it's government and the diaspora walking in the similar trajectory in terms of line with mutual ownership, but those two lines never become one. That's when it becomes politicized. Right. And the bridges that are built between those two lines will be different actors along the way, but they're serving the mission of where you're going. And as you're walking that trajectory, the diaspora have to get benefit out of it in terms of their development. And the government and the nation have to get development impact out of it. And I think where we are at the minute is that we kind of know that that's the journey, But the structures and the systems we have in place are not allowing us to really get those lines kind of motoring at the pace they could do. And look, let's be honest and open and frank about this. Whether you agree with it or not, I think there are incredibly, we're living in an incredibly complex time for the architecture of international development, as was once seen. I mentioned it earlier in terms of around the connotations of power. I think what we're seeing in the world in terms of some of the geopolitical shifts is not just a desire for realignment of power, but a reconfiguration of how power is accessed. And I think certain elements of that discussion are going back to historical applications of hard power, but you have also some ideological shifts around people-to-people power. And I think we're seeing tensions now where the question of ownership and agency and ethics and transparency and accountability in international development, it's wilting under. What's driving all this is that we're living in a world of incredible change. If you look at some of the literature done by many futurists, many critical thinkers on this, the pace of change in the world is phenomenal and it's only increasing. And I think to compare that to the architecture that's been built around some of the key pillars of what we see as important in the world, those architectures are wilting under that pressure. And this will come back to a challenge to leadership within these institutions and organizations. I'll give an example of what I mean. We're very lucky in Ireland, I think, to have an incredibly thoughtful president at the moment in Michael D. Higgins. So he was giving a talk in Rome towards the end of last year. I think it was at the World Food Forum, or that title may be wrong, but it was quite a powerful speech. And it left an indelible mark on my thinking, actually. And he spoke about the role of the UN at the moment, for example, and institutions like that in the world. And he's saying, basically, his message was, my counterparts are telling me that we need to change. And he said, change isn't enough. He said, we need to fundamentally rethink our role in a changing world. And we do. You know, so I think just to kind of take it from what you're experiencing. So what I would say to you as a friend and a colleague, Loxton, is that I'm incredibly encouraged that you're spotting these tensions. Because I think it's important. The first thing is spotting them. But the second thing is having the courage to change them and evolve them. But I think there's bigger questions going on that's rooted in issues of power and agency and ethics and transparency and accountability that I mentioned. And I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that diaspora engagement is also working in that. And I think, ironically, what's really interesting about it is that diasporas are one of the few constituencies that get both sides of this divide here, right? Because they have the local context and they have maybe some of the tensions that the people are feeling in terms of the true impact of international development, but they're operating in the other side of the dial. So I think diplomatically, coming back to the diplomacy of this, I think diasporas could be an incredibly powerful force for good, much beyond national development in the world. And I think that's where we need to begin to think about the role of diaspora in the world that we live in. This is not just about the traditional thinking of diaspora engagement for national development. There's a whole new world opening up to us on diaspora engagement. But I don't know if I went off track there.
I think that provides a useful segue, actually, to the next question, which is about diaspora diplomacy, because you know, that's something that I'm very keen to get your take on, because you talk a lot about it. And, you know, this is something I think that could be a huge opportunity for a lot of countries. Just draw a line under our previous discussion and to connect some of the dots that you already threw out there. You mentioned the Emigrant Support Programme of Ireland. And for those who aren't familiar with that, that's kind of a quite a large funded programme by the Irish government to essentially, and correct me if I've misdescribed this, but to implement its diaspora engagement work. And it's implemented not by the Irish central government, but by diaspora organizations, by private sector, by also local authorities as well. So I think that in some ways also connects to what you were saying about how diaspora organizations should not necessarily be beneficiaries of this work. They should be the drivers of this work, the implementers of this work. And that's in some ways a very concrete solution to that issue. I think also what's interesting about the Irish situation is that there's not only Irish diaspora organizations in the diaspora, but also organizations in Ireland that are working to engage the diaspora as well, which
you hit the nail on the head. And look, the essence of the program is to support the Irish diaspora to actually, as you say, implement what they want to implement. You know, and I think there's a very powerful message in that. So look, I think you hit the nail on the head on that. I might take your tagline, actually, the diaspora to implement diaspora engagement. So I'll make sure that goes in front of the Irish government before the year is out. I'll give you credit, buddy, you know that.
There's plenty that we could continue to talk about when we talk about you know, constraints on the diaspora engagement sector. You know, we didn't really talk much about the measurability of impact, which I think is also a challenge, you know, how to justify everything that we're doing is. But anyway, let's draw a line under that, because I really want to get your take on diaspora diplomacy. And I think a lot of people don't know what diaspora diplomacy is. So perhaps let's start by defining what is that?
I think there's a general consensus that it's the role of country of origin governments, or more recently as well, country of destination governments engaging diasporas diplomatically, right? So I think that's the core of it, right? In the sense of where it's going. But I think it's actually much more multifaceted than that when you take a critical lens and begin to unpack diaspora diplomacy. So in that first context, some questions that you could think about as a government, for example, in terms of what it looks like or what it is how do we engage our diaspora through our diplomatic missions to support our diaspora? How do we engage our diaspora through diplomatic missions to keep them informed about what's happening back home and build networks and relationships? And I think the big question and the big prize in it for country of origin particularly, but also country of destination, is how do we
Oh, sorry, before we talk about the prize in it, how is that different from regular consular assistance that all embassies are?
beyond consular provision and things like that, it will be linked to the strategic domestic and foreign policy goals of the country in terms
So
of
it's more strategic level,
more
and
strategic.
obviously isn't
Based on
necessarily just nationals who, the
exactly.
Brit who gets too drunk in
No, exactly.
Ibiza.
And the final question of the three that will probably speak to that is how do we engage our diaspora diplomatically to advance the strategic domestic and foreign policy goals of our country? Right. And that can be for country of destination and origin as well. Right. So it works for both ways. Because as I say, I think more countries of destination, and particularly Germany, for example, through the work of GIZ, have been leading on this. You know, they understand. And the US, for example, and the UK are getting better at this. When you take an example, when people, you never hear the US diaspora. You never hear of the UK diaspora. Right. When you think, because they do it for a different reason, and that's fine, but it's done from the lens of a country of destination, particularly for trade and security and everything that goes with it. So on one level, that's diaspora diplomacy. But I'm also intrigued about the role of diasporas in diplomacy. And I think that's a component of diaspora diplomacy. So I think we also have to think about how does diaspora engagement become a diplomatic connector between states and countries? We live in a world, Loxton, where difference is being weaponized. Right. And it's being politicized in a way that, you know, and this is what we see in the migration debate. It's quite horrific, to be frank, and incorrect when you look at the evidence and the impact of migration. You know, and one of my heroes in life, one of the key architects of the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process in Northern Ireland is John Hume. And I'm always reminded of John Hume's speech when he was accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. And just to paraphrase it, you know, he gave a line where he said, "Difference is the essence of humanity." And what you have to do with difference is not to fight about it, but respect it. You know, and I think when we think about the role of diasporas in diplomacy and how it can actually tie countries together, particularly in the context of some of the challenges that I mentioned maybe in the last exchange about what's happening in the world and what we're seeing in today's world, I think that's just an incredible opportunity for the world in terms of, you know, shared peace, shared prosperity, and truly shared peace and shared prosperity, because I think that's where some of the tensions lie in the world. But I think synthesizing both of those elements as well of diaspora diplomacy is that the arenas and the agency of land of diplomacy are shifting in front of our eyes. You know, if you sat down 15, 20 years ago and you said to somebody, "What does a diplomat look like?" you probably think of a fancy castle, people in suits. That's gone. Who has actual diplomatic agency and influence now is fundamentally different to what it was 15, 20 years ago. And one of the key actors in that are diasporas. So even while you're answering those maybe first three questions that I put forward in terms of supporting, informing, engaging, and all those type of questions, what we also have to understand is that in the landscape of diplomacy and in the landscape of my old professor, Liam Kennedy, that I mentioned at the beginning, he wrote, we did a conference in Dublin in 2018, and we put out the first ever version of the Routledge International Handbook of Diaspora Diplomacy. And one of his opening lines in that is incredibly and powerful. And he said, "Look, we're living in a polylateral world order where diasporas now are occupying spaces across industry, across politics, you know, across education, across everywhere you look." And this is what I meant earlier. I said, if you actually look around you, there's a diaspora story very close to you every day of life. Right? And I think the diplomatic power of that is what diaspora diplomacy really means to me. How are we strategically mobilizing that for more coherent relationship, not just between states, but between communities, with the shared mission of genuinely building a shared future of prosperity and peace? And particularly, I think this is particularly important for smaller countries, Loxon, if I'm being brutally honest. I think we live in a world, sadly, where we can't depend on the bigger countries in the world to do the right thing anymore. Let's be honest about it. We don't have to look too far into the news of today to see that in action. So I think for particularly for smaller countries, we live in a world where you need global access, you need global influence, and you need global friends. And I think your diaspora bring that to the table to you. So if you have time, I'll share with you two stories.
Please do. I did also want to just perhaps ask you to illustrate the potential of this further by mentioning a couple of examples of diaspora diplomacy in action, good diaspora diplomacy in action, especially, well, perhaps one example from the country of origin perspective and another from the country of destination, country of residence perspective as well.
Yeah, of course. So look, I'll put on the Irish hat for the country of origin. And look, I'll share a story from my own research. It was quite a sad moment, not a couple of months ago in Ireland. We lost two incredible people. I think actually, sadly, on the same day, a guy by the name of Chuck Feeney and a guy by the name of Paul Quinn. So Chuck Feeney ended up giving, Irish American, ended up giving billions to Ireland for education and doing incredible things. Played an incredibly important role in helping to bring peace to Northern Ireland, very well established. The other chap, Paul Quinn, was a lawyer in DC who was a very close friend of John Hume. And his obituary in the Irish Times read, "A fundraiser and a friendraiser for Ireland." Right. And I think that's a living proof. You have different people in different parts of their career and life and interests in terms of philanthropy and advocacy and opening political elections. But that's what diaspora can bring to you as a small country of origin. They can be fundraisers and friendraisers. And I think in today's world, there's enough money in the world. it's the friendraiser piece that's critically important. So when I was researching the Northern Ireland Peace Forces and the role of the Irish diaspora, Paul Quinn's name never came up in the books that I was reading, right? Maybe once or twice. But every time I spoke to somebody that was involved in particularly the Irish-American piece of it, what I was being told is you have to talk to Paul Quinn. And I, as maybe an arrogant young researcher, I thought I knew everybody, right? And the first question I was saying, who the hell is Paul Quinn? You know, and through networks and through connections, I got to sit down and have many conversations with Paul, and he was incredibly gracious and giving of his time and expertise with me. You know, but they're the people that you need, the quiet ones that are in these rooms of access and influence and power. That's an example maybe from a country of origin, that you have those two people, you know, that have power and access and influence and everything that goes with, and they put it to use for good purpose. From a country of destination perspective, I think it's still quite emergent. To give you a good example at the moment, I think we're beginning to see one in Ukraine. I think when you begin to think about some of the conversations that the Ukrainian diaspora are beginning to have in their countries of destination and beginning to exert some influence and pressure to get some more constructive leadership, let me put it that way, in terms of how to help Ukraine moving forward, that would be a case study I would look very closely at. And I think what excites me, don't get me wrong, there's incredible tragedy and, you know, conflict happening in Ukraine at the moment. One of the leading lights of the future of Ukraine, I think, will be diaspora engagement. I think what's, and that won't be just be Ukrainian, by the way, I think affinity diaspora will be very important within that. So, and I think in all fairness to the government of Ukraine, if you look at the signals and the signings coming out, they understand this. You know, towards the end of last year, they appointed an ambassador at large for the global Ukrainian community. You know, President Zelensky last August, when he brought back the head of all the Ukrainian diplomatic missions around the world to Kiev for a conversation, diaspora was very central to what he's talking about. But I think when you begin to look at the mobilization of the Ukrainian community in their countries of destination, I think you're seeing a very powerful representation of that in living times. But I think we have a bit more to go in terms of country of destination, and governments do it from that lens for a different reason. You know, quite often, I think we have a good example at the moment in the State Department as well, through the President Biden's Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement. You know, I think that's, don't get me wrong, there's geopolitical reasons behind that, but it's a signal of how this can actually play incredibly well diplomatically. And even if you look at the State Department, and I think this is a big, big point for countries of destination. If you look at the hiring drive that the State Department did over the last couple of years, incredibly diverse pool of diplomatic talent they're putting together with a lot of diaspora background, you know, so they get this, they understand it. So maybe there are two examples that help kind of contextualize what I'm talking about.
And another example that comes to mind when we talk about country of destination, diaspora diplomacy is, you know, you and I are both familiar with Mina Okuru in Ghana, who is the British High Commission's diaspora engagement manager. And I think it's quite a new role, quite a new department in some ways. And if I've understood correctly, it aims to try and support British Ghanaians to engage with Ghana. How do you see things like that fitting in?
I was a little jealous when I saw that, Loxon, I won't lie. You know, with the competitive Irish UK hat on. You know, but genuinely, the reason I say that, it's not a joke in many ways. I think one of the blind spots in Ireland's diaspora engagement over the years has been more concrete and effective engagement of diasporas that live in Ireland. Now, don't get me wrong, it's in our strategy, it's in our approach, but I think, you know, translating that to action hasn't been to where it should be, you know, so I think that's a critical point. But again, you know, when you begin to think about, you know, why is the UK government doing that, right? The UK government are doing that because they understand they have an incredibly vibrant, you know, upwardly mobile Ghanaian community in the UK. They also know that they can give them access to trade relationships, diplomatic relationships into Ghana. Through that, they can have no doubt access into wider regional and continental discussions around trade and investment and everything that goes with it. Cultural promotion, don't get me wrong. And I don't think we should ever be nervous about, you know, actually saying that out loud. That's okay. You know, that's the way the world works. You know, and I think sometimes we're a little bit too warm and fuzzy on diaspora. When I say understanding the power of that diaspora have earlier on in the conversation, that's living proof of what I mean. You know, the UK government wouldn't be spending on that topic unless there was a strategic value to the UK to do that. So there's a genuinely, I commend them on it, and I say scale it. I think when you look at the composition of the UK community, you know, and don't get me wrong, you know this better than I do because you know my old line, I don't do migration, I do diaspora. Right? In a sense. So look, I'll bow to your superior knowledge on the migration side of the landscape. But look, to my naive eye, I think we live in a world where migration, quite sadly, has been allowed to become probably the most toxic world in public and political consciousness. You know, we don't have to look too far. And I think that's why we need to be careful as well on the diaspora side of who are the organizations that are driving the future of this sector. Maybe the organizations that have got us to that point on migration can be part of the answer to diaspora, but not the whole of the answer. You know, so I think, you know, that's where that example, for example, from the UK can be very powerful in shaping a very positive story around migration in the UK. You know, and you might agree or disagree with some of the political decisions being made, but if you look at the composition of the Ghanaian community in the UK, I've no doubt it's incredibly dynamic, incredibly professional, sharp, contributes a lot to the UK, not just financially, but in different ways. What's not to like about that?
Exactly. They've brought Stormzy, they've brought Danny Welbeck, and a whole host of quasi-Kwarteng.
It's incredible. To the credit of the Ghanaian government, when I talk about the government stepping in and ownership, you know, they did the year of return. They've built out beyond the year of return. So that comes back to the point about ownership that I mentioned. You know, that doesn't happen. And I've no doubt that fed into the decision-making process in the UK that, you know, you have a government here taking this topic very seriously in Ghana. And, you know, what can that look like for Ghanaian-UK relations? And that's a prime example of what I mean about diplomacy. That's how a diaspora community is driving diplomatic cooperation.
Well, on that note, Martin, thank you very much for coming back onto the show. Really enjoyed this. And last but not least, how can listeners connect with you and learn more about Global Diaspora Insights as well?
Yeah, look. Website is probably the most direct way to do it, or through LinkedIn. I'm quite active on that. But look, genuinely, hopefully you came across in the conversation, I see this as my passion, as my calling. You know, what I'd like to do is just try to leave the sector in a bit of a better state than we find it. And look, I want to say thank you to you, Loxon, for your leadership in that as well. You know, from the work that we've done together, but even before that, you know, you've been willing to ask the tough questions that I think many people are not. So I commend you on that. I encourage you to keep doing it. And I look forward to many more collaborations in the future. And in true Irish spirit, let's cause a little bit of trouble along the way.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Migration and Diaspora Podcast, powered by Homelands Advisory, your independent migration and diaspora agency. If you've enjoyed the show and would like to support our channel, please feel free to share it or leave a review via your preferred podcasting platform. You can access the channel's full archive and show notes by visiting homelandsadvisory.com/podcast, where you can also get in touch if you'd like to be on the show. Thank you again, and see you next time.